From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! 8 protesters are arrested at Gore's New Hampshire headquarters. Activists stage a sit-in to protest the vice president's ties to Occidental Petroleum and the drilling for oil on indigenous land in Colombia. Also, black doctors claim they're being excluded by HMOs, and Republicans and Democrats hold their last debates before the New Hampshire primaries. We'll play excerpts. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 8 protesters opposed to an oil company's plans to drill in South America were removed from Vice President Al Gore's campaign headquarters by police yesterday. The protesters from Amazon Watch and other groups wanted Gore to pressure Occidental Petroleum to stop drilling for oil on lands of the Ua people in Colombia. Police said all 8 would be charged with criminal trespass and some would be charged with resisting arrest for linking their arms or refusing to get up. Gore's late father was a vice president of an Occidental subsidiary. Gore owns about $500,000 in Occidental stock. A Gore spokesperson deplored the protest. We'll have more on that story later in the program. Meanwhile, the Republican candidates are debating a slew of issues in their White House quest, everything from abortion to tax cuts to mosh pits. Yes, mosh pits, you know, where people at a concert catch a performer who jumps into the crowd. Well, Alan Keyes leaped into a mosh pit at a rally in Iowa earlier this week that was set up by activist Michael Moore. Last night at the GOP debate in New Hampshire, Gary Barra took Keyes to task for it. Bauer said it wasn't dignified. The grandmothers of Elian Gonzalez are back in Washington planning another day of lobbying lawmakers. Mariela Quintana and Raquel Rodriguez, who are trying to take their grandson back to Cuba, want Congress to drop legislation giving Elian U.S. citizenship. The two women returned to Washington last night after an emotional reunion with their grandson in Miami. The meeting was ordered by the Justice Department and was held at the Miami Beach home of a nun who's long been involved with helping immigrants. The list of tainted cases in the Los Angeles police corruption probe continues to grow. Police Chief Bernard Parks yesterday said the officer at the center of the probe, Rafael Perez, had identified 57 cases in which he fabricated evidence or his perjured testimony resulted in a conviction. A spokesperson for District Attorney Gil Garcetti says prosecutors believe the tainted cases will number in the hundreds. And the foundation that owns Thomas Jefferson's home, Monticello, today acknowledged for the first time that Jefferson likely fathered one, if not all 6, of the children of his slave, Sally Hemings. The Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation released its findings more than a year after a DNA test found that a Jefferson male likely fathered Hemings' youngest son, Esten. The remarks were the first time the foundation publicly acknowledged that Jefferson likely fathered at least one of Hemings' children. And in Washington, Justice Department officials assured an international group of activists that they would review allegations that journalist and death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal's civil rights had been violated. The International Committee to Save the Life of Mumia Abu-Jamal seeking a new trial for him. On January 12th, the committee's delegation presented 29 claims of civil rights violations they believe transpired in Abu-Jamal's trial, sentencing, and post-sentencing proceedings. The group requested President Clinton and Attorney General Janet Reno use their office to secure a new trial for Abu-Jamal. Meanwhile, on January 14th, a federal judge, U.S. District Court Judge William Yan Jr., informed attorneys for both sides he'll review the entire case, including the findings of Judge Albert Sabo, who presided over the trial. Late today in Washington, Abu-Jamal supporters will protest a gala that is put on by the U.S. Conference of Mayors honoring Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge, who has signed a death warrant for Mumia Abu-Jamal twice. We're joined on the phone now by Pam Africa, who is with International Concern Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Can you tell us about the protest that is planned?
Yes, good morning, Amy. Thank you for having us on. The protest is directed at Governor Ridge. There's several people. Harry Belafonte is receiving the Legend Award. He's a civil rights activist, but our protest is against Governor Ridge, and who is receiving the leadership award. And what we're pointing out that this man fully know that Mumia did not receive a fair trial. Evidence points to the fact that he's innocent. He's been getting mail from around the world. Legal experts and all points of government has contacted this man. And for him to stay, to drop the execution warrant on Mumia and join us in, pulling a full investigation into this case. The protests will take place at 10 H Street Northwest in front of the Grand Hyatt at 6 p.m. tonight. And it's being sponsored by the Washington International Concerned Family Friends and the Alexandria, Virginia Concerned Family and Friends.
Pam Africa, thanks for joining us of the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. In fact, he was referred to in the Republican debate rather obliquely, but we'll get to that later in the show.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year, with the blood and the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before, how governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fanned the flame. To those wars that have fought in places we can't even remember their name. On the radio, talk shows, and TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. African-American doctors charged earlier this week that HMOs systematically exclude them and reduce black patients' chances of selecting physicians of similar racial backgrounds. The American Association of Health Plans, which represents 1,000 HMOs nationwide, rejected these charges. The charges were made by the National Medical Association, the largest organization of black doctors. We're joined right now by the former president of the National Medical Association, Dr. Gary Dennis, as well as by Susan Pisano, vice president of communications of the American Association of Health Plans. Let's begin with Dr. Gary Dennis and the charges of your organization.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
We represent over 25,000 African-American physicians and our patients, and we've been in a struggle to try to provide excellent health care for our patients for a long time. But since the managed care organizations have become more network-oriented and less staff model HMOs, a lot of contracts with physicians have been let, which create panels of physicians in networks that unfortunately have not included many choices for African-American patients that they desire. And recent studies show that many African-Americans, in fact, all racial and ethnic groups, tend to want to have a doctor who they can trust and respect, who also can relate to them from their cultural background, sensitivities, language, etc. So therefore, it's very important that patients have those kind of choices. But the African-American physicians have been excluded by a lot of managed care organizations, and I'm not sure whether it's an intentional thing or not, but the result is the same, and that is that many African-American physicians do not participate as members of these health panels. As a consequence, the patients don't have an opportunity to be treated by them. Now, we have had many examples of individual health plans across the country where there have been just severe shortages of African-American and ethnically appropriate physicians, period, where most, or in fact, in one case in Kansas City, all of the African-Americans were excluded. Now, I think one of the reasons is because the health plans have not been taken into consideration the race and ethnicity of the physicians that make up their physician panels. Number two, they don't know whether their enrollees really would like to choose a physician that's of their same ethnic or racial background. And not having that information probably handicaps them somewhat. But the result is that many patients who would like to see a black doctor don't have that opportunity.
Let's get a response from Susan Pisano of the American Association of Health Plans that represents more than 1,000 HMOs.
Well, good morning. First of all, I'd like to say that we believe that this is a serious issue and that upon learning of the press event held by the National Medical Association, our president wrote to the NMA's president to ask to meet about this matter. So we hope to get the opportunity to do that soon to learn more about just what's going on here. First of all, we agree with what Dr. Dennis said, that for many patients, it's very important for them to get the proper treatment, to have a physician who can relate to them and their cultural background. We fully agree with that. I think the literature is pretty clear about it. I think the second thing is that we also agree that it's important to have diverse physician panels. It's important for the patients. It's also important for the plan. It's in the plan's best interest, if the plan is going to grow, to have the physicians in the panel that the patients want to see. And certainly the studies that have been done about this question do indicate that white and non-white physicians are about as likely to get and to keep contracts. Now, I don't say that to in any way dismiss what Dr. Dennis is saying. All I'm saying is that we need to look further and look at what the factors are that are behind what the NMA sees.
Could I make a comment?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, well, I appreciate your comments, but I think the only data that we have is a study that was done in California where managed care has primarily been staff model HMO dominated by Kaiser, and now many, many other HMOs that are more network-oriented, where it's really the way of life, where all physicians are involved in managed care. So if you're practicing medicine, you are working with managed care. Unfortunately, that's the only study that has been done that even looked at whether there was discrimination, is that one study. But what that study showed is that patients who were sicker were being redlined through excluding doctors, whether they were white or black or Hispanic, who treated sicker patients, which means that there are some kinds of selection criteria that negatively impact physicians that treat patients in inner cities. And what we found is that in different geographic locations where we have a high concentration of African Americans in inner cities and you have those doctors treating those patients being African Americans, they are frequently not included in those panels. Now, there may be economic reasons for it, and I believe that part of it has to do with the methodology that's used to select physicians, which may not be as sensitive to those cultural and impact issues. For instance, if you excluded, in my city, I'm a neurosurgeon in Washington, D.C., if you excluded just three of the black neurosurgeons, you would have excluded all but one in the District of Columbia. And including myself, there are three working with me. And we don't participate in many health plans, which means that a lot of patients who may want to have an African-American neurosurgeon for whatever reason don't have that option. And so I think that's what we have to look at, the total picture. We are living in a society where discrimination has been a way of life, especially as it relates to African Americans. The opportunities to train in healthcare have been so limited that it's amazing that we have as many black doctors as we have today. But in the pipeline, in medical school, there are fewer and fewer black medical students because of all of this anti-affirmative action business. So as a consequence, we have shrinking numbers, and when there are even a few black specialists excluded by health plans, patients frequently have no choice at all. So I think that these are the kinds of issues that are different than in the majority population. If you want to have culturally sensitive and appropriate health care, and I think that most people want that, all people, I think that we need to start coming up with some different solutions. And I think that's why we're bringing this out, because most people don't recognize it. It's unique to a society where you have a very small number of like ethnic providers when you're not taking that into consideration when you create these networks.
It's interesting. I think the figures are something like from the American Medical Association and your group, Dr. Gary Dennis, the National Medical Association, 4% of the nation's 700,000 practicing physicians are black, and you compare that to the population of this country of African Americans, which is 12%. Susan Pisano, a number of responses, American Health Association of Health Plans.
Well, you know, it's interesting in talking to medical directors around the country, given all of the controversy that has been swirling around managed care in the last couple of years, one of the things they say is that we welcome the idea that there are physicians who want to be contracting with us and who are talking about this. I think that Dr. Dennis raises a very important question, which is that with so few practicing physicians who are African American, when just a few of them aren't in a particular health plan, that makes a big difference for the patients. And I think we need to give this a closer look, and I think that's why our president has asked to be able to meet with Dr. Shervington to talk about these matters. Certainly, I think that one of the obstacles to getting a better handle on what's going on is that the plans don't routinely ask about a physician's race or ethnicity when the physician is applying to participate with the plan. That's not on the standard application form, so it's not a piece of information that's readily available to the plans. I think it's also very important to know that there are some rules that apply to how health plans put together their panels, and they do involve geography. They do involve making sure that the physicians in the panel are close by where patients live. So we have to look at what role that's also playing. So I think there are a number of things that we need to be taking a very close look at.
We only have a minute, but I would like to put this in the context of this presidential election year 2000. Last night, the Democrats and Republicans debating separately in New Hampshire. The issue of health care was raised a number of times. Dr. Gary Dennis, can you put the issue of the population of African-American doctors in this country and also the particular issue of exclusion into the presidential race? And do you have a favored candidate that you think would make a difference?
Well, first of all, you know, the National Medical Association has been firmly behind the race and ethnic health care disparity campaign that President Clinton and our Surgeon General, Dr. David Satcher, have promoted. So clearly, we are certainly behind all the positive things that have occurred in the last few years. We haven't really made a commitment about any particular presidential candidate. Certainly, Vice President Gore and his commitment to health care of all Americans, his well-thought-out incremental inclusion of more Americans in the healthcare system so that they can receive the kind of treatment that they deserve, I think is laudable. And any candidate that can move towards universal coverage in a prescription healthcare benefit for patients is doing the right thing for all Americans.
And the American Association of Health Plans, Susan Pisano, have you come out with an endorsement for presidential candidate?
We have not, but we think that it's encouraging that the question of how to get more people coverage has come to the fore. And I'd actually just like to make one final point on today's discussion, which is one of the ways that health plans build
their
physician panels is by recommendation of patients. We think it's very important to have the physicians in the panel that our patients want.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. How can people get in touch with your groups, Dr. Gary Dennis, National Medical Association?
Yes, 202-347-1895. You can contact me through email at gcdennis@pol.net. Thank you very much.
And that one more time, that phone number?
202-347-1895.
And Susan Pisano, the American Association of Health Plans.
Our number in Washington is 202-778-3200, and I am S. Pisano, that's S-P-I-S-A-N-O, at AAHP.org.
That's 202-778-3200. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll find out just what happened yesterday in Gore's Manchester headquarters and why 8 people were arrested. And we'll go down to Columbia to get a report from there. Then we will hear excerpts of the Democratic and Republican debates last night and hear Gary Bauer ask Alan Keyes why he jumped into Michael Moore's mosh pit and what he thinks about rage in the machine. Or was it rage against machines, I think he said. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, you wouldn't know it from watching television, but 8 environmental activists were arrested yesterday inside the New Hampshire campaign headquarters of Vice President Al Gore as they conducted civil disobedience to protest Occidental Oil's plans to drill in the Colombian rainforest. Now, what does Gore have to do with Occidental Petroleum? Well, the protesters from the groups Amazon Watch, Rainforest Action Network, ACERCA, and the Native Force Network were demanding to speak with the vice president over the growing crisis in Colombia. Gore owns up to $500,000 in Occidental stock, and his father was closely tied to Occidental, and Armand Hammer, its owner, was in fact a head of an Occidental subsidiary, Gore's father. The California-based oil giant plans to drill its first well in a land that activists say is the ancestral homeland of the indigenous group, the Uwa of Colombia. Last week, Democracy Now! Took a look at the vice president's involvement with the company, both as a stockholder and as a major player in the multi-billion-dollar sale by the Clinton administration of a vast oil-rich area in California known as Elk Hills. And that sale was made to Occidental. It was the largest sale of federal land put into private hands in the history of the United States. These ties to Occidental are what activists say put Gore in the position of being able to influence the company's plans to drill in Uwa land. We're joined now by Kim Foster from the Rainforest Action Network. She was one of the 8 protesters who were arrested at Gore's headquarters. What happened yesterday, Kim?
Hi, yes. We walked into the headquarters and were approached by a young woman who said that we knew why you were here. You're here for the Uwa, right? And we said yes. And she said, you're welcome to do your demonstration outside. We said that we were here on behalf of the Uwa people and that we wanted to talk to Vice President Al Gore or someone about the situation in Colombia and the vice president's connection to Occidental Petroleum and the threat of genocide in Colombia. At this time, she said we needed to leave and go outside, and we all started filing into the office. She said that she would be happy to have someone come outside, but we refused to leave. At that point, she called on, she went into the back and got Representative Buckley to come out and talk with us. He said that he would be happy to have some information and get back to us. And we went out and got him a press packet, brought it in for him, and he then said that he would send somebody to, he would call us. At that point, we still reiterated why we were there and that we would not leave until we got a response and that they needed to call the vice president. He said that that would not be able to be done. At that point, there was a photographer who was being physically removed from the campaign staff outside, as well as our legal observer, who was also brought outside. At about this point, we all decided to sit down and refuse to leave until we got an answer.
If you could make it as fast as possible, because we're going to also go down to Columbia, and we only have a few minutes.
Sure, sure. At that point, the police came in. There was a lot of mocking and laughing from the staff people. We started chanting. They started chanting back, "Elect Gore." And then the police did come in. They asked us to leave. We refused to leave again until we spoke with the vice president about the situation, and they began removing us one by one.
And are you the only person who's gotten out of jail at this point, or has everyone?
There are still four people left in jail.
And what are you all charged with?
And we're charged with criminal trespassing and resisting arrest.
I just think it's very interesting. We were watching TV all day yesterday in the background in the office and saw, we didn't see mention, maybe CNN did a little piece on this, but throughout the day did not see mention of what happened to you in the offices, despite the fact that there is massive coverage of what's going on in New Hampshire and a great deal of discussion of the style of the candidates. This is a rare occurrence to have people arrested inside a candidate's office, and which is why we really wanted to explore it. Now, yesterday, if Democracy Now! Listeners were listening, we interviewed the California press secretary for Al Gore, David Shea. He refused to comment on the Occidental story, even though the company's based in California and Elk Hills is also in California. But when contacted yesterday for reaction on the arrests in New Hampshire yesterday afternoon, the Gore campaign said no one would be available for comment until Wednesday. Of course, that's a day after the first primary in this country, and that is the New Hampshire primary. But the UWA first became known internationally a few years ago when they threatened to commit mass suicide if Occidental drilled on their territory. Now they continue to resist Occidental's efforts to explore for oil in new ways. In October of last year, about 500 members of the community occupied the area Oxy would like to explore, which they say is their ancestors' land. And in November, the community purchased from local peasants the exact piece of land where the company would like to drill its first exploratory well. But on Friday, the Colombian military arrived in the area and proceeded to force the UWA off the land. And 2 days ago, 26 members were still on the land, were evicted, taken away by Colombian military helicopter. We go down now to Bogota, where reporter Stephen Dudley is and filed this report.
In a press conference, three UWA leaders calmly explained that the arrival of 5,000 armed troops to the area alarmed them, but not enough to force them away from what they claim is theirs. Roberto Perez Gutierrez is an UWA leader. And they told us that we should leave the area because they're going to start drilling for oil, he says. And what did we say? We told them that we're not going to leave because this is our land and our ancestors' land. The UWA say they bought the land in late November from two farmers who were preparing to leave. They illustrated the legal deed and made reference to the notary's signature. But their deed did not serve its purpose, and the Army proceeded to round up the UWA members and usher them into a helicopter. The Army then took most of them to their reservation located just a few kilometers away along the Venezuelan border. But the indigenous leaders said three of their community members are still missing. The UWA's claim of military abuse came on the same day that the Colombian government completed a deal to allow for oil exploration on the land. As far as the government is concerned, the UWA issue ended when the government increased the size of the community's reservation last year. Alberto Calderon is the president of state oil company Ecopetrol, which stands to make at least 50% from whatever oil is found on Oxy's Samoré block.
What I would emphasize there is that the let's say from Ecopetrol's point of view, what we saw was that the size of the reservoir was multiplied by four, and that, as you saw, it took a huge chunk of the Samore area. So that's something that we were surprised, and it's something that we were not particularly thrilled, but that we accept, because this is a state of law.
Calderon says the government has the right to all the soil beneath the topsoil, and that Occidental had obtained all the correct legal papers. So even if the land is the UAS indeed, the California-based company would still have the legal mandate to drill for oil. The UAS is also facing a difficult political battle. While support for their efforts has soared in from abroad, most Colombians are less than sympathetic to their cause. Oil is the top export product in the country, accounting for millions in sales and tax revenue each year. But oil production hit its peak last year, and without more oil reserves, the country will become a net importer of crude by the year 2004, a prospect that will quickly bankrupt the government and the country. Despite the seemingly uphill battle, the UA leaders said they would continue to resist Occidental's efforts to drill for oil, and even reiterated the group's now famous threat.
Desde ese momento, la posición de los pueblos indígenas UAS ha sido tomado muy claro que no a la exploración petrolera en territorio anticlano.
We are not afraid of death, UA leader Gutierrez says. We are prepared to give up our own lives to defend our land. For Democracy Now!, I'm Stephen Dudley in Bogota.
That report from Bogota, Colombia, now back up to Manchester, New Hampshire, that news conference held yesterday in Colombian capital. Kim Foster of the Rainforest Action Network, you were getting arrested at the news conference of the UA was being held there. Your final comment.
Yes, we will continue to question Gore. What he does today will determine us if he will stand for human rights and the environment, or will he support big oil?
How do you plan to get the message out, since the press doesn't seem very keen on your protest? Though I will say that the Associated Press put out an extended report and did explain what the issues were. But that goes into newsrooms, not out to the general public. And then from there, news editors decide whether it is printed in newspapers or broadcast on television.
Right. We continue to bring people up and getting this issue recognized by holding demonstrations and being a presence in Manchester this week.
If people want to get in touch with the Rainforest Action Network, where can they call?
They can call 1-800-989-RAIN.
That's 1-800-989-RAIN. And I know your website, www.ran.org.
Right.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we go now to the last debates before the New Hampshire primary, the first primary of the election 2000. We'll begin with the Democrats. They faced off yesterday, Vice President Al Gore versus the former senator of New Jersey, Bill Bradley. No, the reporters who were asking the questions did not ask questions about the Occidental Petroleum Gore connection, and Bradley did not raise the issue, although we know the campaign knew about the issue. Yesterday of the connection between Gore and Occidental Petroleum, but they discussed a number of issues, and this is Judy Woodruff of CNN beginning.
The first question goes to Mr. Gore. Most people believe that you are an honorable man, but when it comes to electoral politics, your critics, including some Democrats, say that you will do almost anything to win, including reinventing yourself, using consultants, no matter what their reputation, and running not just a tough, but a mean-spirited campaign. Newspaper editorials here in New Hampshire and around the country accuse you of distorting Mr. Bradley's record. Is this really necessary to win your party's nomination?
Well, Judy, I strongly challenge your characterization. And there is nothing that I have said in this campaign that is in any way mean-spirited. I have never run a negative personal attack against my opponent, and I never will. I have never even mentioned his name or shown his picture in an advertisement, and I have no plans to. Now, I think that some people who feel uncomfortable when the substance of positions is criticized confuse free-spirited debate on the substance of issues with
negative attacks. It's not a negative attack to defend Medicaid when Senator Bradley proposes to substitute vouchers or subsidies, as he prefers to call them, limited to $150 per month per person. It's not anything but an exercise in democracy to defend Medicare and say what all the independent analysts have said, that because the baby boom generation is about to retire, doubling the population of Medicare recipients, we need to start putting money into the trust fund. Senator John McCain has the same position.
Well, Mr. Vice President, there have been evidently several distortions of Mr. Bradley's record, and I'm going to cite just two of them. You charged, for example, that his health care plan would eliminate federal standards for nursing homes. It would not. Number two, you've charged in supporting that he, in supporting pilot private school voucher programs, which he did, he voted to siphon off money from public education. Excuse me, which is also not the case. Now, was this a matter of misinformation, or were you just being political?
Well, Judy, I disagree again with your characterization. Federal nursing home standards are enforced by the providing of money under the Medicaid program to more than two-thirds of all the nursing home patients who get as much as half of their money from Medicaid. When the federal government says, look, you have got to abide by standards, the only threat they have to enforce those standards is withdrawing money. Now, on public school vouchers, private school vouchers, Senator Bradley voted every time it came up in the Senate for private school vouchers. It's pretty well accepted that there is a limited amount of money in communities for public schools, and that if you take some of that money and devote it to private schools, over time, that is going to result in the siphoning of money away from the public schools.
Thank you, Mr. Gore. Mr. Bradley, I want to get right to the heart of the education issue with you. So can you go ahead and clarify your voucher position then at this time?
Sure. I don't think that vouchers are the answer to the problems of public education. I voted for it several times when I was in the Senate as an experiment. There are now two experiments going on. I don't think it's the answer to the problems of public education.
The way you've been talking, I just don't see how you can vote for Ronald Reagan's budget cuts and then try to campaign like Robert Kennedy.
And one final from you, Mr. Bradley.
Well, let me just say, when Al accuses me of negative campaigning, that reminds me of the story about Richard Nixon. It said Richard Nixon's the kind of politician who would chop down a tree, then stand on the stump and give a speech about conservation.
Mr. Bradley,
just won't fly.
Mr. Bradley, your turn to pose a question to Vice President Gore.
Al, Hillary Clinton said the other day that consistency on fundamental issues of principle is important. She went on to express how she and Rudy Giuliani have the same position on choice now, but that he had changed his position to arrive there, and she had always been there. My question to you is, do you think she's wrong?
I've always supported Roe v. Wade. I have always supported a woman's right to choose. And let me say that if you entrust me with the presidency, I will guarantee that a woman's right to choose is protected. Now, it's true that early in my career, I wrestled with the question of what kinds of exceptions should be allowed to the general rule that Medicaid should also pay for this procedure. I have come to the strong view that all women, regardless of their income, must have the right to choose. And that's my position. Now, the next president is likely to appoint as many as three, maybe four, justices of the Supreme Court. All of the Republican candidates who were in this studio have taken a pledge to overturn Roe v. Wade and support a constitutional amendment to take away the right to choose. We basically agree. We have exactly the same position. So if you want to manufacture a distinction, okay. But if you want to know my position, I favor a woman's right to choose, regardless of the woman's income.
Well, you still didn't answer the question whether consistency on fundamental issues of principle is relevant. I think they are. And I can understand why you wouldn't answer the question, because when you were in the Congress, you had an 84% right-to-life voting record. And it seems to me that this is an issue that requires somebody to know where they stand and to know why they stand where they stand. I respect people who have a different view than I do. I respect your position that you had. People can evolve, but your campaign shouldn't go around saying that you've always been for a woman's right to choose, because the record shows you have not.
All right, well, let's go on. Let's go on to the next group. Mr. Gore, you have a question for Mr. Bradley. I'm sorry.
I thought that I did. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
I have always supported a woman's right to choose, and I support it today. And
That's not true.
I have always supported Roe v. Wade and a woman's right to choose. And the fact is,
Ow,
the exceptions
that's not
on the
true.
If I could finish, I haven't interrupted you, Bill. The exceptions to the general rule that Medicaid should provide funding for abortions constituted virtually the only votes in the House of Representatives during those years. And I've told you that I wrestled with that. But if you want to know what my position is, you can look at the record and you can hear me right now, and not just here, but in every speech that I have made. I support a woman's right to choose.
All right, if you could ask a question now, Senator Bradley, Mr. Gore.
Yes, on the question of welfare reform, I believe that it has been an important achievement. In fact, we have moved 7 million people from welfare to work, cutting the rolls in half. You voted against it in the United States Senate, and I'm wondering why.
I voted against it because I didn't think it was in the best interest of the country. And I'm wondering why you think it's working so well when, because of welfare reform, there are 1 million children in this country today who don't have health insurance, who've lost their health insurance because of welfare reform. I also think that although the welfare rolls have dropped, that people in deep poverty have increased. And when I look at this vote, and I say what this vote really was a gamble with kids for re-election. In October 1996, that's when the vote took place.
You're listening
to...
That's
when the discussion took place.
Bill Bradley and Vice President Al Gore in their last debate before the Democratic primary in New Hampshire next Tuesday. When we come back, we'll hear from the Republicans. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to the Republican debate that took place last night in New Hampshire, just before the Democrats sparred. And this is the debate between, among others, and they will be identified as we go along, George Bush and John McCain, Alan Keyes, Steve Forbes. And as they go, they will introduce. They will be introduced by the reporters questioning them.
I've got a vibrant charter school movement. I've got a public school choice movement. There, we're making the best progress in the nation for improvement amongst minority students. That our minority students, because of our strong accountability system, are making tremendous improvement. That our schools are ranked as some of the best in the country. Steve, our public school system is meeting the challenge. In terms of the budget, I've slowed the rate of growth down. And when you take out population growth and inflation, It's by far the slowest rate of growth ever in my state's history in terms of tax cuts. I not only led our state to a $1 billion tax cut in 97, I led our state to a $2 billion tax cut in 1999. Real, meaningful tax cuts. But I guess the way to answer your question is, you know, the people of Texas took a look at my record. The second biggest state in the union, a mighty important electoral state for any Republican running for president. And they said, Mr. Governor, we accept your record. And they overwhelmingly voted me back into office. I nearly got 70% of the vote.
Well, George, on SATs.
That was George Bush. This is Steve
Forbes. Texas is one of the few states where minority scores have gone down, not up. Standards have been dumbed down. Eighth grade science test in Texas shows picture of four insects and says pick out the fly. So that's why the test scores have been not going up. Now, again, how are you going to improve education nationally when in Texas it's gone down? And in terms of tax cuts, yours is a tax cut that only Clinton and Gore could love when most people don't get it.
Steve.
Your own budget director said six out of ten didn't get it.
Let me answer, okay? You know, the people of Texas looked at the real facts. I just explained them to you.
What are the test real scores, facts on SATs?
Please don't interrupt me. Let me finish, okay?
Well, answer the question.
The test scores in my state on the NAEP test, which compares state to state, show dramatic improvement. And that's objective analysis after objective analysis has ranked Texas as one of the best education states in the country. It's not only because of me. It's because of teachers and principals and parents. One reason our SAT scores have improved since I've been the governor, you need to get your research to do a better job. But unlike many states,
your ranking went down.
And now we turn to John McCain on education vouchers.
You're asking to money to take out of public education for vouchers when they need that money. Let's kill off that sugar subsidy. Let's kill off that ethanol subsidy that helps nobody except perhaps Archer Daniels Midland. And let's take that money and put it in the education of our children. That's where we can really help parents in America.
Governor Bush, you have a rebuttal to that. 30 seconds.
My rebuttal is that we spend a lot of money on disadvantaged children, which I support. But there must be high standards set at the state level. My program says states, John, I am a governor, and I understand what federal controls are, and I understand federal mandates, which I've opposed. But I believe we owe it to our children to say to the state, you need to set standards, and you need to measure. And if the schools don't rise to the challenge, as opposed to allowing the status quo to reign, we need to free the children. We need to free the parents so they can make a different choice.
Mr. Keyes, you get the next question.
Thank you very much. I'd like to address my question to Steve Forbes. Steve, I'm very concerned with the surrender of America's national sovereignty and steps that have been taken in recent years that undermine our allegiance and application of our Constitution. Particularly, I'm concerned that by joining the World Trade Organization and subjecting the American people directly to decisions taken by an unrepresentative body that will then be applied directly to their affairs without the intervention of their elected representatives in the Congress or elsewhere, we subvert the American constitutional system. Would you join me in a pledge, because of that assault on the Constitution which it represents, to withdraw this nation from this unrepresentative body, the World Trade Organization, and reestablish the sovereignty of the American people in their international economic affairs?
I believe in the sovereignty of the American nation and the American people. I believe in a U.S., not a U.N. foreign policy. I believe that we should destroy or send the International Monetary Fund to the political equivalent of Jurassic Park, given what it's done. Concerning the World Trade Organization, Clinton and Gore have made a total hash of the thing. The whole thing was supposed to be designed to mediate trade disputes so they can reduce barriers that are in the way of our products and services. We're the biggest trading nation in the world, and they discriminate against our products like no other nation. The WTO is like the woolly mammoth. I think we have to take direct action. If that organization can't get its act together, let it stay on the side, and we take direct action, as I propose to do, in reducing trade barriers with our partners, starting with the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement with Ireland and Britain. And we should do the same thing with Australia and other countries in the Pacific Rim. That way we can stop this discrimination against our products, and the WTO can go its own way.
Good. Mr. Bauer, for Mr. Keyes.
Alan, a couple of weeks ago, you criticized my good friend John McCain because he expressed some support of or interest in a controversial music group. In view of that, I was a little surprised this week to see you fall into a mosh pit while a band called The Machine Rages On, or Rage Against the Machine, played. That band is anti-family, it's pro-cop killer, and it's pro-terrorist. It's the kind of music that the killers at Columbine High School were immersed in. I don't know, don't you think you owe an apology to parents and policemen on that one?
Actually, I don't, because I was in no way. Accusing me of having some complicity in that music would be accusing me of I don't know, being responsible for the color of my skin. When you can't control things, Gary, you're not morally responsible for them. And I was not morally responsible for the music that was playing as I stepped out of my rally and faced Michael Moore, whatever his name was, doing whatever he was doing. That's his concern, not mine. And until you told me this fact, I had no idea what that music was. Contrary to our friend John McCain, who expressed the view that that this was his favorite rock group. I think telling somebody that it's your favorite thus and such is actually taking responsibility for the choice and making it clear to folks that this is something that you prefer and that this is something that you care about and so forth and so on. To do it in a lighthearted way, rather than having it imposed on you by circumstances of which, over which you have no control, is something that I think is totally unacceptable. So I think that I would beg to differ with you. I had nothing to do with that music, disclaim any knowledge of it. Admittedly, I was willing to fall into the mosh pit, but I'll tell you something. Do you know why I did that? Because I think that exemplifies the kind of trust in people that is the heart and soul of the Keys campaign. It's about time we got back to the understanding that we trust the people of this country to do what's decent. And when you trust them, they will, in fact, hold you up, whether it's in terms of giving help to you when you're falling down or caring for their own children. So I thought that as an emblem of that trust, it was the right thing to do. And anyway, my daughter thought it was a good idea. Yeah. I do know that when I got down, one of the folks who was there with one of the news crews looked at me and he said, you know, you're the only person I've ever seen dive into a mosh pit and come out with his tie straight. And I think that, you know, the real test of dignity, the real test of dignity is how you carry it through hard times. I think I learned that from my people. We went through slavery when we didn't have the outward signs of what others would call dignity, because we understood that dignity comes from within, and that whatever circumstance you are going through, you can carry that dignity with you, and no one can take it away. So I think you may have a misunderstanding of dignity. It doesn't come from what you do in a mosh pit. It comes from what you do as a result of the convictions of your heart. And I'll leave it to the American people to judge the convictions of my heart.
We're going to move on to a question that all of you will have an opportunity to answer, 30 seconds each, beginning with Mr. Bauer. The question is this. The Commission for Presidential Debates has issued its criteria for determining which candidates will be admitted to the nationally televised debates this fall. One of the requirements is that all candidates must be showing 15% in the polls. Some feel that 15% rule has the potential to exclude independent candidates, specifically the Reform Party nominee. Do you think that's fair?
I don't think it's fair. In fact, I think we should stop relying on polls, period. Whether it's to pick who's a serious presidential candidate, or what's even worse, to decide what policies we ought to be pursuing in Washington, D.C. This process ought to be as open as possible. The American people deserve that. They certainly deserve not to have elites, whether it's some organization or pollster somewhere, deciding who they're going to get a chance to hear from and who they're not going to have a chance to hear from.
Governor.
Yeah, I think it's fair. I do. Because I think otherwise there's going to be a stage with 50 people, and it's going to be hard for the candidates who have a chance to become the president to be able to make their case. I hope the debates don't turn out to be a kind of an Oprah Winfrey style, who can walk around and who can feel people's pain the best. I hope they're open, honest, straightforward dialogues based upon the philosophy. And I'm confident that any of us up here can take our philosophy and make the case to the American people compared to who we may be running against.
I think it's totally unfair, and I think it would give a dangerous power to pollsters and to those who are capable of manipulating those polls, and I think it would be anathema to the process that ought to leave these choices in the hands of the people. You won't get 50 people on a stage if you set the threshold of participation in those debates at the proper level of qualification in states around the country. It was not easy for the Reform Party to meet the qualifications, but once they have objectively met the qualification to be on the ballot in a sufficient number of states to win the electoral votes needed for the presidency, no polls or anything else ought to keep them out of the debates. You are depriving the American people when you do that of a proper choice.
Senator McCain, I want to return to a subject matter you alluded to earlier in our debate. The U.S. Supreme Court this week upheld the rights of states to cap the amount of an individual's contributions to political candidates. The court rejected the notion that contributions deserve First Amendment free speech protection, although the court didn't address the issue of soft money contributions. Is this court's ruling seen as a stepping stone in your eyes to further campaign finance reform?
This court ruling is a magnificent affirmation of the efforts that I and reformers have been making for many years. And you know, Governor Bush says that it's unilateral disarmament if we get the special interests out of Washington. I see it as a clear road to victory, because when I'm in the debate with Al Gore, I'm going to turn to Al Gore and I'm going to say, you and Bill Clinton debased the institutions of government in 1996, and you were engaged in reprehensible conduct, and then you said there was no controlling legal authority. I'm going to give you the controlling legal authority, and I'm going to make what they did illegal. And George, when you're in that debate, you're going to stand there and you'll have nothing to say, because you're defending this system. You know, you said that it's bad for our party if we have campaign finance reform. I've always had the belief that's what good for our country is good for our party.
Let me follow up by asking you then, Senator, by and large, the Republican establishment opposes the campaign finance reforms that you propose. Why is that?
And if there's anybody around that wants business as usual, they don't want to vote for John McCain. I'm not proud when the Republican Party has taken $7 million from the tobacco companies. I'm appalled when I hear of these new setups of millions and millions of uncontrolled money that will never be disclosed. We know what happened in 96. Chinese money flowed into the United States of America, and our national security was compromised. That's wrong. That's wrong.
Thank you,
and
Senator.
Until the last breath I draw, I'll give the government back to the American people.
Governor Bush, I'm going to give you 30 seconds.
I appreciate the way you've characterized my position. I'm for reform. I sure am. Wait, I'm for reform. I'm for getting rid of the corporate soft money and labor union soft money. But I want to make sure big labor toes the line, too. And that's the difference between what you're for and I'm for.
You know, and I know that labor gives millions of dollars and it would be affected also.
May I finish, please?
Fine, I'll be glad.
Thank you. Paycheck protection is important to make sure the playing field is level. And you can call all kinds of names you want. But the truth of the matter is, an overwhelming number of your members of the United States Senate on the Republican side do not support your plan because it's not fair. And that's the reason why.
Thank you. John McCain, we're going to give you 30 seconds to rebut.
Well, I mean, look, we know what happened. We know what's happening. It's now legal in America for a Chinese army-owned corporation with a subsidiary in the United States of America to give unlimited amounts of money to an American political campaign. I don't know how you defend that. We know that the labor bosses go down with the big checks. We know the trial lawyers go down with the big checks. We would ban that. Clearly, we want paycheck protection. But really, we also know what's going on with some of your people right now. They're setting up soft money to be used in the media reports in the general campaign. My friends, we've got to fix this system before it lurches out of control and young Americans won't take part in the political process.
Republican debate in New Hampshire last night. In Manchester, that was Arizona Senator John McCain, Texas Governor George Bush, millionaire Steve Forbes, Alan Keyes, and Republican Administrator Gary Bauer. That does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland, our technical director. Thanks to Nicole Sawyer. From the studio of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.